Hello and a massive welcome to the 132nd Hulkcast. As usual, I'm James Rushton, your host. And again, I'm joined by Danny Riser. How are you getting on? It's been a fucking great day. Sorry to start off with a curse word, but mate, I'm really excited.
Now, of course you're excited, man. It's been a ridiculous weekend in general. It's been one of those where I don't know why there was a real sort of hype behind this particular derby. And for me, it was one of those which at the end of the match, you're going to be left feeling one of two ways about the whole weekend. It's what dominates your whole life, you know, if you're a Villa fan or a Birmingham fan for those two particular days. And at the end of the day, man, we absolutely tore the Birmingham City players to absolute pieces. And I was lost for words with the performance today.
Yeah, of course, it was the 126th second city derby between Aston Villa and Birmingham City. For those who are counting, of course, we're certainly not. But yeah, man, nerves. You get nervous when Villa and Blues play, not for any good reason, because Villa have done well in the recent record. Not the early, not 10 years ago, we weren't doing well in these matches. But we're really getting the upper hand, and it just felt maybe that Birmingham City on off the back of some decent form, you know, regardless of who they played and how easy those matches were for them to win. They're coming off the back of some decent form for them. And it felt like maybe the bloody nose is on the card. Maybe it's the time they steal a late draw or snatch a late victory even. And it honestly, we'll get into the discussion of the match in a bit, but it didn't actually feel for 1 second, bar that Sam Gallagher miss, that they were going to do any damage.
No, absolutely. And that Sam Gallagher miss, for example, I'm sure we're going to go a little bit further deeper into it. That was the absolute like worst angle that you could have got without the ball going in, which is, you know, proper shame for him, obviously. It was one of those where, yeah, we were in total control for the whole part of the game, right? And it never felt in doubt. Now, Birmingham City, I don't know what happened to them today, but it's like they turned up at Villa Park and the game was lost already for them. And there was just that sense of confidence running around all our players, right? We showed more fight than Birmingham City. We looked like the team that wanted to win the game. Scott Hogan was running all over the place. He made some stupid decisions, but boy, oh boy, did he look like he wanted to score. I think that Birmingham City side just collapsed under the pressure.
There was a lot of pressure as well. The focus is always going to be on Villa, though, because we have so much to lose. If we lost, I mean, would it be still a big deal that we keep the status quo a few points behind Derby? Yeah, but it's not about losing and dropping points. It's about losing to your closest rivals in a very deflating loss at home when you should be winning, especially after all the hype, 6 games won. But once, you know, we woke up at 9:30, I got picked up at 9:30, sorry, and we drove to Aston and walked around. People drinking in the street. There's flares going off. You know, there's a general excitement, and that was from Villa fans, and there was no nerves. There wasn't much. It was just constant, yeah, let's do it. Let's just, you know, we're here. We've got to go for it. And Aston Villa, as the football team went for it, the fans went for it, the whole club was gunning for Birmingham City today, and Birmingham couldn't cope. And people on their side are saying that Steve Cotter will learn from this, and he's not a baby. He's been in the management game a while. If he's not learning now, then he's never going to learn. But they didn't offer anything. So we'll go into the match, mate. The first big instance I can remember is Scotty Hogan hitting the bar with that sweet strike from just outside the box. Destined for the net, that was. That was a cosmic strike.
There was a lot of dip on that ball, wasn't there? There was a lot of dip on it. It was in the air. Obviously, he actually had to beat a couple of players for it. You know, it was being marked out quite a bit. The ball bobbled favorably for him. And you know, if he had a little bit more luck, that would have gone in. And it was just a sign of the intent. You know, we see Scott Hogan as a 6-yard player. A lot of the time, you know, a player who's going to get on the end of a cross, perhaps within the area and tap one in. But over there, Scott Hogan looked like the next Robbie Keane.
Yeah, that's certainly a cracking strike. It was incredible how Hogan was able to involve himself in every single instance of gameplay. Today, I'm sure he was throwing in last-ditch tackles in our box and while sprinting forward and spearheading an attack. And I think he's really, really become someone in a Claren Blue shirt. He's not just a bit part player. He's become his own character almost. You know, Scotty Goal, Scotty Hogan, he's there going to grab a goal out of nowhere. And I'm really happy that it's actually happened, because it'd have been easy and legit to write him off. It was done. It was completely done here.
Scott Hogan's one of those unique players, I think. I think he's got one of those personalities of somebody who's destined to succeed at something. You know, when you look at self improvement, and you look at how do you become successful at anything, not just football, you got to have a certain type of attitude. Scott Hogan has that kind of attitude. Lewis Graben was signed, right? Before Lewis Graben was signed, obviously we were looking at big targets. You know, even Robin van Persie was in the fold, you know, for a potential striker to put him in. Scott Hogan, over that period of time, he said in the media himself, he said, look, it doesn't matter who comes in, I'm holding my place. He's definitely showing that so far. And the other thing that I found really interesting from the commentators today showed another aspect of that personality from Scott Hogan was, I didn't actually realize this, and yes, I was watching it at home. The game was absolutely sold out by the time I could get any tickets. One thing I did hear from him was that Scott Hogan, apparently, when he was going through that time period of not getting a look in, and when he came back from his injury, apparently he was calling up his former manager and asking for advice on what he was doing right at that particular time when he was banging in goals, and what can he do at Villa which can sort that out. And he's looking like a new player since he's come in. And I almost think it's because we're telling him to press a lot more.
Man, he's done really well, and absolute full credit to him, man. He's come back from a pretty horrific, it was like a bowel obstruction injury, and those really aren't nice. I know a few people who've had to have that type of surgery.
It sounds bad.
It's fucking intrusive. That's what it is. It's really impersonal. And it's not just, you know, a cruciate injury or you broke your bone. It's an invasive operation, and it's not comfortable. And for someone to go back into such a physical role shortly after that, and then have the best period of form for his current employer, you know, full round of applause for Scott Hogan. He might not be grabbing the goals every single game, but he's coming up big where it matters. And his off the ball work is fantastic. I mean, he does encourage Al Mohammadi maybe too often to do that big right flank hoof over the top, which doesn't always come off, but he's always there waiting. He's a proper predator up front.
His positioning is second to none. And I think the other thing was that I found really, what I really liked about him today was he was coming back quite a lot. There was a one moment in time where I believe he lost the ball further up the pitch. I can't remember if it was him that lost the ball or somebody did. And he ran back almost to left back position to help recover that ball. And then obviously the ball was sort of was passed back over the top of the defence, Scott, with Albert Adoma almost taking his position over there. But he's just not afraid to run back. And it's not like he'll stick around there as well. He would run back, he'd make that tackle, and he'd go straight back into his position as a striker. And I thought he did incredibly well today. And to the point where you're looking at Lewis Graben and thinking, mate, this guy's not letting you in the team.
Yeah, for good reason as well. No offence to Lewis Graben, who is maybe too good for the Championship, but not good enough for the Premier League. He's one of those strikers that falls into that weird slot. I'm hoping Scott Hogan can do one better. He does look like a Premier League. What separates a Premier League striker is not just the instincts, not just the pace and the physicality. It's the instincts and intelligence. Scott Hogan's got that in abundance, and he's always willing to learn, which is an absolutely fantastic trait that not many people have.
Do you know what, on that? That's an interesting point. Strikers that are good enough for the Championship but not enough for the Premier League. I'm trying to think of
who. Dwight Gayle could be another one.
Billy Sharp, maybe?
Yes, fantastic. Andy Keogh, back at a throwback, a mid-2000s throwback. Andy Keogh, or Keogh, I don't know how to say that last name. There's been a few of them that you do get a lot. Who, David Nugent.
Chris Wood.
Yeah, well, he's doing all right, isn't he, for Burnley? Don't want to take that one away from him just yet. What, you are right. You're not wrong. You're definitely not wrong for saying that.
There's a lot of them, isn't there?
You're in the right direction, but yeah, it works for us if Lewis Graben's still got that form. You know, he banged in the goals for Sunderland in style. Not enough for them to be at the position they currently occupy, but enough to get on the radar of some decent clubs like Villa.
But you know, one thing that we've done wrong over the last few years is when we've brought in these players right here, you say good enough for the Championship, not good enough for the Premier League necessarily. I mean, you look at like Ross McCormack, I think potentially you look at him a couple of years ago, definitely good enough for the Premier League, would have liked to see him in there. You know, we brought in that kind of a striker and we don't build the team around them. When you look at these strikers, they've been the main guy at the club that they've been at. Scott Hogan was the main guy at Brentford. He came in at Aston Villa and then we're not playing around him, obviously the first time he's come in. And then, you know, you're also looking at Ross McCormack. Same sort of thing happened with him. Jonathan Codger, he performed fine with us because we played around him. We played to his style. And I feel like Lewis Graben might well have that issue. If we're now playing to Scott Hogan's game, he is going to struggle to get a look in. But whilst we're playing to Scott Hogan's game, hey, he's banging him in. And hopefully this long reign of form continues. I absolutely love the energy from him.
Well, yeah, if only that goal went, it would have been a cosmic out of this world strike if that went in. But a big chance afterwards for Albert Adoma approaching half time. Didn't really pull the trigger when needed to. David Stockdale, I believe the Birmingham City keeper, was able to palm it away. Maybe should have been a goal, but you really want to see these players take the chance. You know, pull the trigger, take the chance, and maybe you get the drop on the keeper in the defence. It was far too predictable, shot straight at the keeper. And that's the second big chance for Villa in that half. After, though, we'll go into that Sam Gallagher chance, man, because that's where Blues really should have thought about taking the lead. I'm not talking about the first shot, which hit the post and rolled back into play. I'm talking about the second when he's got practically an open goal. That should be 1-0 to Blues.
Do you know, I feel like I missed that. I'm not going to lie. I don't know. I don't think I feel like I missed the open goal chance.
No, the open, it was directly after. It was literally seconds after he hit the post. It bounced back to him.
Yeah.
He's on the left of Sam Johnston. Everything, you know, it's there. Tapping, mate. You can do this. And he spoons it miles over and into the halt end. It should have done a lot better. He's a prestigious quality striker. He's bagged 7 goals so far for Blues this season, and they're in a diabolical position as well. So he's not bad. It just didn't come up for him when he needed it to.
Yeah, look, I said Sam Gallagher would be the danger man for Birmingham City last week on the podcast, obviously. Thought more with his head and, you know, clearly proven he's not very good at his feet sometimes. I mean, that was an awful chance. I mean, that was an awful miss, but I think he was probably shocked straight away. You know, when you're one-on-one with a goalkeeper, you know, let's not take too much away from him. You're one-on-one with a goalkeeper, you're expecting to score, you're expecting to bury it. He did not expect that to come straight back off the post. And very, very rarely, if it does hit the post, does it come back like that, straight at you? He can't have been braced for it. And look, he's, what is he, 6'4", something like that. I don't mean to generalize, but usually strikers who are that kind of tall, he's not an overly bulky fella either, aren't going to necessarily have the best of balance to tap one straight in from there. You're looking at guys with a better sort of, control of their body, you know, being closer to the ground, who are going to be able to tap one in when it comes to chances like that, if that makes sense. I wouldn't necessarily expect Peter Crouch to have buried that opportunity.
Well, credit where credit's due, mate, even if he is a blue nose, that, you know, to get a shot that close to goal from that angle is pretty decent. But yeah, thankfully he didn't bury it.
No, thankfully he didn't. One thing that, you know, you do worry about with Sam Gallagher as well is that whilst he is good in the air he's seen for his height. The thing that I did see from him today was he did have a lot of drive. He did look to beat defenders, and that is something very, very rare for a striker of his size. And I was impressed with him in that respect. I was, however, confused when I saw him on the left wing trying to beat El Mohamedi and put a cross into the box, because that's where he should have been. But there was a few things that confused me about Birmingham's attacking lineup anyway.
So we go into halftime. First 45 minutes over, we see Jack Grealish get stamped on by Shaken Doi.
Yeah.
There is a part of me that thinks, you know, he can't help that. He can't help the motion of his body. But, you know, the studs land on an ankle, man. It's not nice to see at all. He obviously got his just desserts later on. But we go into the first 45 minutes. There's been action. There's been bravado. There's been a few scraps. There's been slide tackles. There's been dodgy runs. There's been missed chances. There's been, you've hit the post upright every part of the goal except the net. There's been last minute saves. It's 45 minutes. The second City derby. It's 0-0. What are you thinking when we go into that second half?
I was pretty happy with it, if I'm totally honest. I didn't leave that half thinking, right, we've wasted a load of opportunities. Birmingham are going to hit us back. Because for that 45 minutes, after that 45 minutes, I don't think the difference in fight between the sides was going to change. I thought for the full 45 minutes from that point, Villa were the team that were in the ascendancy. They were the team that wanted to attack. They were the... Look, Birmingham City, I talked about recently, under Steve Cotchell, for their pressing game. James, I did not see Birmingham City press at all in that first half. They did not keep Villa under any pressure whatsoever. Yeah, they had one chance, but...
The only time I remember any pressure is when John Terry fell over and it let, I believe, Sam Gallagher through on goal for that exact chance.
Yeah.
That's it. That was a momentary lapse of judgment from John Terry, who was, you know, 9 out of 10 the rest of the game. That's it. That's shocking, man, because I understand Birmingham City are close to the relegation zone. I understand all of that. However, it was Villa with so much more to lose. You know, if Birmingham City come... Pressed us out of the game, went for every ball, went beyond the call of duty. They could have won or drew that game. Villa were great, don't get me wrong, but they weren't faced with any major opposition, and that's quite embarrassing.
Look, Jedinak stamped out everything pretty much that Birmingham City were throwing at them. The defence barely had to move for half the game. It seemed like the ball was being lumped up by Stockdale, you know, forward, hoping that David Davis would get a nick on it, hoping that Magoma would be able to cut inside, or Jeremy Boga. But whenever they did get the ball, I think like Adoma and Snodgrass, both of them just dropped back. You know, they weren't necessarily pushing too high up the pitch to start with, but they just kind of dropped back and put the pressure on. And then Jedinak, or even Grealish and Hourihan for large parts of the game, would just nip the ball off the Birmingham City midfielders and run with it. I just didn't feel like Villa were under any danger. So I was thinking to myself, unless Steve Cottrell's some sort of a master motivator, there's no way he's going to be able to deliver a halftime talk which is going to make Birmingham City put in any more effort than they did in the first half. Not a considerable amount anyway. And there's no reason why Villa would drop the pressure either, because if I'm Steve Bruce, I'm incredibly encouraged by the way that Villa were performing. And I'm just telling Scott Hogan, do your thing, right? You're doing perfectly fine out there. Keep on going. Keep on playing how you are. And, you know, obviously coming out there, being a little bit fresher, Villa were able to eventually capitalise.
A bit more on Steve Bruce, mate. It's a bit of a, you know, a darker, saddened tone. He did lose his father earlier in the week, unexpectedly, whilst his mother's in declining health. Obviously, all condolences go out to the Bruce family. But, mate, when Albert Adoma scored, have you seen the clip of him cheering? He's like in tears. And that is, you know, I think we've said a lot about Steve Bruce in this podcast, and there's a big part of me now that does want to take a lot of that back, because you do realise that he is human. It is his job. He gets paid to do this. It's potentially could be the last big job of his career, mate. If he falters at Villa, he doesn't go to a club bigger than Villa. But full respect to Steve Bruce for coming out on that. He didn't need to be on that sideline today. He didn't, you know, no one's expecting him to do his job today after all that. And he come out and he did it. And I think really, really, really pleased with him. And I really wish the best for his family, Alex Bruce as well, his son, of course, giving us all the news. So do follow him on Twitter. But yeah, I can't speak enough about him and his character. What amazing strength that is!
Yeah, no, tremendous strength from Steve Bruce to go out there and manage the team regardless. And obviously it is a sad somberton to drop into, but it's something that we need to mention. First things first, you know, nothing wrong with criticizing a manager for tactical decisions or whatever, which we have done on the podcast. But like, I think Steve Bruce has earned a lot of respect from Villa fans over the last couple of months or so. But regardless, you know, any man who turns up to do his job following the loss of a loved one like that, you have to give him some sort of commendability for it. And he turned up today, And, you know, not, you know, let's commend Steve Bruce, but let's also commend the players. They were very, very clearly very motivated. They didn't let him down. You know, it looked to me for large parts of it that, you know, you could consider saying that the players were in a way doing this for Steve as well. And it was nice to see a sort of a positive atmosphere. Now, I'm not incredibly sure, but from what I know as well, the Birmingham City fans didn't give Steve Bruce a bad reception either. And I have to say something for that as well.
Of course, yeah, you can't ignore that, because when you're dropped into a derby atmosphere at an away stadium, it is a cauldron of potential hate. You're going to hate on everyone. You're going to hate on the fans. You're going to hate on the ball boys. You're going to hate on the players. And I didn't hear the Birmingham City fans much, that must be said. However, I don't remember them ever giving Steve Bruce a stick, and I think we'd have heard a lot about it if they did. However, that's not the case. So plaudits all around. I think he got a great reception. No one took the piss. Everyone was, you know, no one was booing or getting frustrated. Everyone was there for Steve Bruce. He is our manager.
Yeah.
And he is our manager for the future. You know, he is Aston Villa now. He is the Villa manager. He isn't just Steve Bruce at Aston Villa anymore. It's become Steve Bruce is the Villa manager.
He's been here a considerable amount of time when you consider what's happened with other managers over the last few years. And he actually delivers something positive. He motivates the team and he plays a style of football. Now, obviously, you can give some of the plaudits to Steve Agnew as well for that. There's a style of football which we enjoy, and there's no negativity at the club. And I think that's the main thing that we've seen with Steve Bruce. Since Gerard Houllier, there has not been a manager who has sort of you could perhaps say Tim Sherwood, but I don't think since Gerard Houllier, really, we've had a manager who's kind of, you know, talked about positivity and moving forward. And I think, you know, one other thing to say is, if at the start of the derby today, right, Colin Calderwood is outside of the at the dugout, he's leading the team. Let's say hypothetically Steve Bruce has taken a week off or something, right, and Villa go out and put out a performance and still lose, then you know what, you can be forgiven for that. But at the end of the day, Steve Bruce turned up, did his job, got the team playing well, tactically made fantastic decisions, such as starting Mile Jedinak, which obviously would have taken a lot of thought, and Villa won. And like I say, big plaudits all around, and it's got to be commended.
Yeah, incredible. So we go into the next 45 minutes, mate, and Aston Villa actually take the lead. Jack Grealish, I hate the statistic assist, because if you pass to someone at the halfway line and they dribble for, you know, the rest of the way and score, you get an assist. This is a genuine assist. This is him playing the ball into an area that only Albert Adoma is going to get to, and only Albert Adoma is going to score from. Assist from Jack Grealish, second City derby. Albert Adoma, of course, puts it past the post, past the keeper as well, into the net. Rapturous. The celebrations, mate, I don't know how I can put it into words. I ended up about 5 or 6 seats to my left. My dad actually fell over on his back into the row before, and he was saved by a bunch of people gathering him. But it was limbs, I think is the correct term.
It was rapturous, wasn't it? It was rapturous. And I cannot even begin to describe my reaction. My jaw dropped, right? And forget the ball through that Grealish played. That whole attack was ridiculously good. There were three players at work over there, right? I'm not sure if you would have noticed this because, you know, you're looking at it and, you know, you see the goal. But Jack Grealish had two Birmingham City players jockeying towards him. He dragged and he had the ball for a good 5 or 10 seconds, right? These Birmingham City defenders dragged themselves out trying to corner Jack Grealish, and any other player would have been cornered. Adoma makes that run inside, right? These Birmingham City defenders are now out of position. Grealish has dragged them out. Doinked that ball perfectly for Albert Adoma. It was a slow pass as well. Albert Adoma's walking past, right, because a Birmingham City defender, I believe it was Mark Roberts, is expecting Scott Hogan to get the pass over here. Scott Hogan holds him off, almost as a bit of a dummy, and Albert Adoma just gives himself a ridiculous amount of time to blast that into the back of the net. That attack was beautifully worked, and that is one thing I have absolutely loved these past few weeks. We have had some beautifully worked goals. There is some amazing football being played up there. And these players, these attackers are just working as a unit.
Oh, mate, that's not the only goal, is it, though? If you thought that one was good, and let's be honest, the movement was good for that. It was brilliant. Jack Grealish setting up the goal. Albert Adoma just finding the right place to put the ball. Conor Hourihan's goal, absolutely stupendous. Obviously, Villa late on weren't really threatened too much. There was maybe a bit of nerves having the one goal lead. Conaghan gets the ball on the, I believe it's left, right flank. At this point, I'm obviously looking at the pitch a different way to how it's portrayed on TV. But yeah, he's on the right flank. The ball just drops to him. I think he, did he hit it first time or second time on the bounce?
I think it was second time, yeah.
On the bounce, he hits it. And it's one of those goals where the second he arches back to hit it, you know it's in. You know it's going in. And when the ball's in the air, it's dipping heavily, flies into the net. Mate, just a masterpiece.
It dipped right in and it went top corner as well. There's no goalkeeper in the world who's saving that. Because when a player's that far out, right, goalkeepers don't stand that far back on their line. And
it's got the three things that make a shot impossible to save. It's got speed, dip, and curve. But it's not only got that, mate. It's cutting from the position he's hitting. It's going across him. So he's got to get into this horrible position where he's going back, but he's also going to the side as well.
Yeah, exactly.
In the almost diagonally. So he's not saving it.
No one's saving it.
And he didn't have the best game. However, he grew into it. And I think that is another thing that has to be commended. You had an average first half. You fell over. You weren't getting into the game. When it mattered, mate, you showed up big, and I think that is Conor Hourihan in a nutshell. Man, the dude shows up.
Yeah, but even then, you got to remember the two midfielders he was up against. You know, obviously, we can look back at this game and think Birmingham City were awful, but mate, Clifton Beldon and Doi as a central midfield partnership—that's solid. That's fairly solid. You know, it's difficult for a player like Conor Hourihan.
You can't really argue against it, can you? But they just didn't do. I think Shaken Doi was a bit too heavy-handed with his job. You know, can't blame him for that, really. It's a derby.
Oh, he was, yeah.
However, we just got the better of them constantly. They just didn't show up, mate. And that's it's not a good look, is it, if you're dangling above the relegation zone. If your big occasion comes, you know, your big shot, and yeah, it's just a letdown, complete letdown.
We need to draw a line. It's very, very easy to fall into this trap. We need to draw a line between Birmingham City under Harry Redknapp and Birmingham City under Steve Cotterill. Was there anybody in between there? I can't remember.
No, it was straight to the.
No, they had somebody else in charge for a little bit, didn't they? Like, they had an interim manager. Anyway, right. I think
Cotterill might have been the interim because he was an assistant under Redknapp.
Was he? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well. Either way, right? I think you got to look at Cotterill obviously being Birmingham City manager and what difference he's made, right? And obviously he's had them playing well. They've been playing good attacking football. You know, they've been capitalizing over the last few weeks. You know, this isn't a Birmingham City side which has been in awful form, but they almost reverted back to it. Now, you know what you got to remember is that I think you know Clifton Beld being you know. A German machine, like, you know, he obviously played very, very well today. I've got to say, you know, amongst all the other Birmingham City players, right, who didn't necessarily turn up, I think Clifton Bell played very well. Cheken Doi, he made some really bad challenges. Now, I almost feel as though Steve Cotterill told Birmingham City to go out there and rough Villa up, and it just did not work. And it went all over their faces because, you know, immediately when you go out there and tell your team to go ahead and do that, you're preparing for a team to basically fall back and get taken, you know, taken aback by it and basically get shocked by it. Villa were happy to just take the fouls, you know, take the free kicks, take the opportunities. All it meant was that we kept having the ball and we just kept on running. We just kept on throwing the pressure on Birmingham City. So you can rough Villa up all you want in that respect. You're not going to stop anything. And I just thought that... it felt like some of the challenges that were going in there today and the fact that Birmingham City were getting so many bookings, it felt like it was a tactic gone wrong. I'm not sure though.
Aston Villa have this weird thing though where if you press them and come at them, they genuinely kind of play. There's certainly some players who play better. We'll go on to that actually because we'll big chat about Jack Grealish, mate. He's been playing extremely well. We can't, you know, say enough about that. However, today he came onto his own. Ran the show completely. And we say that every single week. However, the stage was here and he's done it. He's done it in front of the entire world watching the Second City Derby, you know, the world famous Second City Derby that neutrals were tuned into despite both teams being in the second tier. He made the promise, you know, I'm going to, you know, this is my game. Eventually, my dream is to score against Birmingham City, get the winner in front of the whole end, win the Second City Derby for Aston Villa. He didn't score the goals, mate, but he... he effectively won the game.
Do you know what? The again from him today was ridiculously good because he added another element into his game, didn't he? Today he showed another element of it.
Yes.
Because we've been praising him for his attacking ability and the fact that he's so good at creating chances and obviously pushing forward with the ball. But when I saw him dispossess Jeremy Boga today, I was impressed. I was like, this is Jack Grealish is reaching his peak now. He's not weak anymore. He's not got those gangly little arms that were, you know, getting him dispossessed all the time. He's worked on his upper body strength, man. He dispossessed Jeremy Boga and he brought the ball forward. That was something that I liked about Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain when he was playing for England back when Roy Hodgson was leading them in the World Cup. I like midfielders like that who can tackle, but at the same time drive the ball forward and create something.
It's great to see, mate. I don't know another player in the world who's doing what Jack Grealish is doing, and that's not to say he's world class or international level. It's just to say that his role is extremely strange. Again, it's a conversation we've had plenty of times where he's a 10, he's an attacking midfielder, but you'll find him in the centre, and you'll also find him dropping back, pressing, throwing in tackles, winning the ball. He's effectively this weird forward-lying, ball-winning midfielder, and his role almost makes no sense, but for him, it's perfect, and he's doing everything so well, and I cannot be pleased enough for him. He's got his head on straight. He's becoming a player we all knew. Not just that, he's becoming a better player than we all possibly knew he could be. We saw him on the wing, and he's tricky on the wing. He can throw a good cross in. He's running the show in all thirds of the pitch, in all phases of the pitch for Aston Villa. And mate, I get the piss taken out of me when I say, yeah, maybe we should think about him for England, but dude, do you know anyone else who's doing, he's putting in the work right here is from that role?
Well, Jack Grealish's position. If I'm thinking about the Premier League, thinking about the Championship, I can't think of much in the Championship. I suppose you can have a look at, is it Kearney at Fulham, perhaps? He's obviously doing some work. Not to Jack Grealish's level, I wouldn't say. There's got to be a couple of players at Wolverhampton Wanderers that you can offer a shout in, but it's like you say, man, it's the way that he plays, it's the position that he plays in, it's very, very weird. I can't think of many players who do the same thing as him, even at England level. There you go, Dele Alli. That's the kind of player that he is.
You know, that's a fantastic comparison. I believe Dele Alli, you could probably say maybe twice the player Grealish is. But the one thing about Dele Alli that is not there is the mentality. He's a very, very, very tricky character. Some of the tackles he's thrown in, some of the things he's done on the pitch are really definitely not something I'd endorse. However, I think if you're looking at someone to back Dele Alli up, why not Grealish? I'm not saying Southgate take him to Russia. I'm saying why not? Make the argument why you wouldn't consider. I think it would be very hard to argue against it. I think that maybe the only argument you could say is, oh, he plays in the Championship. But isn't that something that you can say is better for him when he's he's the top player in the league. Every week people are trying to kick the shit out of him and he's still doing this.
I like your argument, but I almost feel like there's even more of an argument for the England manager, Gareth Southgate, to say, why would I pick him? I think it's
difficult because it's biased. It's obviously biased as well. But you get Wolves fans coming at you and saying, oh, why would you pick, you know, he's got 82% passing rate, that's shit. Hang on a minute. Aston Villa play long ball. They play direct football. They do have really nice bits of play sometimes, but mainly they're looking to get forward as fast as possible through dribbling and through crosses and long balls. However, he's got the best pass success rate in our team. Yet, if you're Wolves, you're going to have pass rate successes of 97% because you're playing the ball along the back line. Yeah. You know, you keep holding them onto the ball. You're passing around.
I'd love to see Reading's pass accuracy. They do the same thing, don't they? I mean, I would love to have seen our... If we want to talk about Villa's pass accuracy, right, let's bring back Paul Lambert. Let's talk about passing accuracy there. You know, keep on passing the ball along the back line until you eventually get pressed down and beaten. But, you know, obviously, I think Villa do a very good job of pressing. You know, Brendan Rodgers said something really interesting, didn't he, like quite a few years ago, and everybody kind of took the mick out of him when he said about dominating positions and dominating play. Dominating space, that's what he said. I almost feel like Villa do a good job of that. They do kind of maintain the shape that they want in a way where, you know, they're always keeping tight and it's always very difficult for a team to kind of run around them. So, I mean, I wouldn't take too much I wouldn't take that much interest into statistics when you look at somebody like Jack Grealish, because a lot of the time what you look at is assists and you look at goals, isn't it? But with some players, you just can't do that. And I mean, when if you want to go by that level as well, you got to look at the amount of flops who have been signed and end up just not being any good following looking at statistics. I mean, Emmanuel Riviere, who got signed by Newcastle, you look at statistics like his assists and his goals record, and that guy was on absolute fire. And you wonder why when he came over to Newcastle United, he did awfully. But he was playing at Monaco, who were a Moneyball team, and obviously playing around better players. I think when you look at Wolverhampton Wanderers as well, you've got to look at the way that they play. They've got some fantastic players in their team, and yes, they're going to dominate games. So the statistics are going to be favourable to certain players.
What I will say is the reason I focus on the pass success rate is because Villa are a team that genuinely don't care about holding onto the ball. They will lose the ball. They'll get dispossessed. They will waste shots. They will waste passes. They'll waste crosses, and they'll get dispossessed dribbling. Having a pass success rate of relative decency, when you consider the fact that the team Villa are, you know, they will punt the ball. They will just ram the ball up you. You know, managing to complete a man of passes shows that you're the focal point, shows that you're running the show, shows that you're the man who will make the chances for Villa. And I think if it's easy for other teams to look at that and go, oh, that's shit compared to ours. Hang on a minute. If you're a team holding onto the ball, your pass accuracy is going to be great. And then it's a pointless stat because it's not within the relativity of the team. It's useless.
The defence barely have the ball nowadays when you look at Villa. You used to get worried, didn't you? Because you'd see a lot of backwards passing. And seeing our defence hold the ball and then pass back the goalkeeper, resulting in another punt. You don't see that anymore. You know, it happened under Paul Lambert. I think it's been happening for years as well. I even remember Stylian Petrov being slated for it quite a while ago. And that's a long time ago. But what do you see with Villa now is obviously the defence, they defend. You know, that's all they do. They defend. Mile Jedinak, it almost stops them from having to do anything half the time. Birkir Bjarnason over the last couple of games as well.
Done the same. It's just pure discipline in that, you know, that defensive midfield role where you will sit on the halfway line and you won't move forward.
Yeah.
You know, you are an anchor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know. So you're looking for players like Adoma to get into space, and that's your focal point. That's what you're concentrating on. You're not looking at, you know, giving Adoma the ball just because he's further up the pitch. You're looking at, do I give Adoma the ball or do I give Snodgrass the ball? Who's got the most defenders around him? Who's got a fullback near him who's going to be able to support him? And, you know, we do really, really well at that. You know, Alan Hutton a lot of the time, right? Here's another one, another good example for it. Alan Hutton a lot of the time, you see him hold the ball quite a bit. Now, a regular fullback might bring the ball forward a little bit and look for the nearest pass. What Alan Hutton tends to do is he tends to keep on going until he drags players out of position, either cuts inside and finds new space or uses the space that he's created to find another player who's in an even better position. And you see that happen a lot as of late. A lot of other teams might just try to be a little bit more patient, keep on working until a team shows an opportunity. But the problem is, a lot of the time, you might not get that opportunity. And I think that the way Villa play, the way Villa drag players out of position, and the way that our attacking players basically run the show, I think it's a great way to see us play. And look, we've talked about it before. We've got four attacking midfielders in our midfield and one defensive midfielder. We've got to utilize them. There's no other way for us to play.
One thing that comes to mind is that Villa seem to play, not, I wouldn't say in a similar style, but it seems they've got the same idea as Liverpool and especially Huddersfield, where it's just get the ball forward, ram it down the throat. If you miss, start again. That just go and go and go and go. And I don't know if that's something Steve Bruce has brought in. I don't know if that's something they're kind of finding through instinct, but it really is a pleasure to watch, because I think a lot of people say that, hang on a minute, Aston Villa don't play the best football in the league, but I see Villa constantly go for goal, constantly, and it does remind me a lot of Liverpool. Is that crazy?
Yeah, but the funny thing is, we weren't playing like that up until a few weeks ago. I don't know where it's come from, but all of a sudden Villa have just started gegenpressing. I don't know what's happened. I don't know whether Steve Bruce has forced them all to watch videos of Jurgen Klopp's Borussia Dortmund, but they're running around all over the place and pressing. Now, I don't even know if this is a plan. Maybe it's just the fact that they're that motivated to go up that they're doing it. And maybe it's just the way players are supposed to play. But never have I seen that sort of chemistry or link-up play between our attack. When we were getting relegated and we were getting our asses handed to us in the Premier League every single week, you know, the players just didn't look like they knew each other at all. You'd see players running offside and then, 2 seconds later, somebody putting the ball through. And then half the time, you'd see our strikers looking at each other like, what are you doing? But the players seem to read each other so, so well that you can afford to do that. You know, you can afford to speculate and you can afford to kind of press and hope things come off because they're that sort of, their thinking's that in line with each other that eventually they're going to find an opportunity.
So gegenpressing, of course, is the German philosophy or what's come about from Jurgen Klopp moving over and especially David Wagner coming into ascendancy with his job at Huddersfield. It's about winning the ball back as quickly as possible. And Jurgen Klopp, or Klinsmann, especially when he was in charge of Germany back in the day and United States, it'll be about immediate ball recovery. You know, as soon as you lose a ball, get it back. And it's not just about throwing in tackles. It's about surrounding people. A big part of the philosophy is, you know, you need to get as many players as you can in the fewest possible zones. However, you need also the biggest distance. So you're almost creating a piggy in the middle situation where you're surrounding the player with the ball, but it doesn't look like that to the naked eye. However, when you're the player on the ball, will immediately look left and right and it's just claret and blue shirts, claret and blue shirts, claret, you know, surrounded. He's got no options. That's what Villa do. And I don't know if they're doing it. Part of me says it's Aston Villa, so they're doing it by accident. But you can't do that by accident. It is a plan. It'll be impossible to do what they're doing by accident. Because if they did it by accident, mate, it'd look like schoolyard football, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And they share that responsibility. And half the time our fullbacks are that far up the pitch that they can sort of win the ball back. And you know, the players get covered, don't they? You know, you'll see El Mohamedy sort of trying to press out a left back and Robert Snodgrass will be holding position. And I think it's all about that support, isn't it? I think if you're going to cage and press, what you've got to realise is that some of your players might well get dragged out of position. It happens, right? That's what happens. Your players are running towards the defence and you need good cover behind you. And I think we do see a lot of that from Villa. They cover each other well. And I think that's what you need. You need to share that responsibility of winning the ball back. And I think the way that Villa win the ball back as well, it's very messy. You know, we're not necessarily dispossessing players cleanly, but a lot of the time it's going to be through blocks and, you know, little pokes. But that's all you need if it helps you win the ball back.
A big theory in gegenpressing or Jurgen Klopp's style of like heavy metal football, you know, like fast, intense, turning up to 11 football. I'm taking this from Spielverlarung, the website, German football website. A big part of it is a 5 second rule. That doesn't mean when you drop food that you have 5 seconds to eat it. It means that if you lose the ball, you do everything in your power in 5 seconds to get that ball back. If you're not getting the ball back in 5 seconds, drop back because you're not winning it immediately and you're wasting your energy. And that seems a lot more what Villa are doing. They gun for the ball. When they don't get it, they realise they set up another opportunity to get it and they're playing very smart and they are really taking the championship to task right now through that.
Oh yeah, and gegenpressing is basically FIFA football, right? In the sense that, you know what I mean.
You hold down X and you're fucking beaming at them.
Right. No, well, you're doing that, but also what you're doing is you're holding one other player to block out the player that you think your opponent's going to pass to. Now, obviously, it seems like simple interception, but it's not necessarily because it's about, you've really got to think one step ahead. You've got to press as a team in anticipation of the other team's ball forward. And you need sort of your other players to pivot around them. And it's about getting all of your players almost zonal marking the other side, if you know what I mean. It's not as complicated as I'm making it sound right now, but basically think one step ahead of your opponent, block out the passes that you think they're going to make. Sounds pretty simple at the end of the day, but I suppose part of that as well is when you've got one player pressing, the opposition player with the ball, then you can almost force them to make a pass in a particular direction as well. So that's why it works so well.
It's weirdly intricate, especially when you see it at a higher level. It's because in theory, it should be like kids just constantly sprinting after the ball. But in reality, it isn't. It's a complex system where you are It's almost like entrapment. You're trying to find a player with the ball. You're sending and one man, you know, the one gazer to win the ball back, but he's got no, then he'll have no options. If you don't lose the ball, he's got no options.
It's almost like rugby union. All the forwards move in a pack, right? Yeah, they move together and they move in a synchronized way. So much so that if the ball is lost, then you can sort of pivot back and kind of work yourselves back in a position to win the ball back again. And if it fails, right, and the opponent get into your area, then it's fine. Drop back and just defend as you normally would. But yeah, it's about moving as a pack, and it's about Liverpool actually did this long before Jurgen Klopp as well. I suppose the gegenpressing part of, you know, pressing the team a little bit further up the pitch was always been there. But what you'll notice about them as well is that, you know, they get players surrounding the other side and basically just not giving them any space to pass the ball out. It's something they've been doing for a long time. But it is good to see that in practice at Villa. I think it works incredibly well. And the reason why it hasn't been deployed long before Jurgen Klopp is because, you know, we had the pressing game before. But I think gegenpressing is all about the high pressure, high intensity section of it. And you need to have a really, really fit team for that to work. You know, you can't be playing gegenpress if, you know, you got Dean Windass up front. Do you know what I mean? You need to have seriously fit players for that.
You're going to have professional, motivated players work as a unit because, you know, you got to hunt the ball down as a pack. That's probably the best way I could describe it, mate, hunting the ball down as a pack. But yeah, if you're listening to this and you're a tactical expert, confront us about this. This is, you know, a first. I think we have never actually discussed a philosophy like that on the podcast. So yeah, do hunt us down exactly like a gang and press and get in our face about it if we're wrong. You know, we'd love to hear you and maybe put your thoughts up on the site. That'd be really good to have someone look at how Villa play and see if they can dissect it. Just get in touch about that. But yeah, man, we'll get to the end of the Blues match. Shaken Doi sent off with a red card for wrapping his throat around John Terry, who didn't seem too bothered. Didn't seem too bothered about it, mate, to be honest. Sent off, did the long walk. Villa, you know, the match is sorted. It's out of their hands. It's 2-0. It's over. Done.
You know, done. Do you know what? After we scored that second goal, I tweeted straight away, Birmingham City are going to get somebody sent off, right? And you know what? It doesn't take a psychic to see it. But as soon as we scored, they were all over the place. They were just getting so frustrated, weren't they? They were rattled. And they just ended up, you know, dragging Villa players down and just making careless challenges because they looked desperate. And it's like, you were not putting in this kind of effort earlier on during the game. Just because you're fouling players and just because you're bringing the opposition team round doesn't mean you're going to be able to score. You can't rattle a side that is 2-0 up against you. You know, I'm sorry, but the moment's gone. And you could just tell they were frustrated. Chaken Doi obviously wants to be playing, you know, at a higher level than he is. But him picking a fight with John Terry, it's just like, what are you doing, man?
Madness.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure Chaken Doi would beat John Terry in a fight. I'm like, he's 6'3" or something like that, right? But you know, you don't just grab a hold of a player's neck in the middle of the pitch. You know, it's just, I think that's going to be looked at, and I think he's going to get a worse punishment for that. If he wasn't on a yellow card, that would have been a straight red, and they lost it. Birmingham City, and there always is a moment in time during these Villa Blues derbies where you think someone's going off.
Let's get on to those questions, actually, because we did take in a few questions. One is about an off-the-ball incident. Jedinak kicked out or had a stamp. I haven't actually seen it. You know, I didn't see it at Villa Park, and I haven't watched the I've recorded the match, mate. I'm going to watch it after again. I didn't see it. I can only comment on what I saw. But if he did stamp out, you know, I wouldn't say I'd like to see him get punished, but it's just what should happen, really. You don't do stuff like, you know, I don't want to drop to Blues' level. They've done that stuff. They've got the punishments for it. Don't want to drop to that level.
You know what? I didn't remember seeing it, if I'm totally honest. Apparently, he had a little bit of a kick out. I think that's what was kind of described. In fact, let me just do this, right? If I can't answer this and you can't answer this, I'm going to consult Twitter right now. So if I search, this is what you do, by the way, if you ever want answers to anything. If I search Jedinak stamp, I'm going to see if this actually happened. There we go. Typing it in as we speak. I realise this does not make great radio, but this is how we did it. Okay, so what seemed to happen was, Doi tried to stamp on Jedinak, And Jedinak ended up tripping him. That seems to be what happened. And I think that's what sort of led to the incident, wasn't it? I think it was both the two of them basically getting at each other, getting into each other for, you know, the reason that obviously they're both under pressure. It's late in the game. So I suppose they might well look at that and think, right, if Ndoye's getting punished, then perhaps Jedinak should be. But when I look at that, I think both of them obviously were fairly guilty. And I think Ndoye, I think Ndoye's going to get banned for the choke on Terry, if I'm totally honest with you. I don't think the stamp or the kick out, I don't think that's going to get punished. I think it will be Ndoye getting punished for choking John Terry. I think that's really what was serious. You do see little kick outs happening in games, but I don't think either of them really meant it.
Yeah, so that's from at Sterling Wilson, Ace, on Twitter, Sterling Wilson. Thank you for that, mate. We do have another one from our man, Trevor Hood, who's been, you know, he's been counting down or keeping track of our predictions. I got victory snatched away from me. I predicted a 1-0. Thank you, Connor Hurahan, for taking the first victory of the season away from me. However, he does have a question. So that's at Trevor Says on Twitter. He's been a really good supporter of us both, to be fair. So thanks, Trevor. He wants to know, who is your man of the match? Mine's Jack Grealish, no question. But I want to know who yours is.
Yeah, I had to think about this, right? Because part of it, I was thinking, you know, you got to look at Mile Jedinak now. Mile Jedinak did really, really well in the first half. That's what I was thinking. But as the match went on, it was the attacking players, wasn't it? It was the attacking players who really got into it. I thought Conor Hourihan played well and did really well to score that goal. I thought Adoma worked himself into space really well during that game. And I can see why Jack Grealish gets a shout as well. If I was to think of one, I think I do end up going with Jack Grealish, purely because of the amount of work he did in that midfield today. He had no business out-muscling the likes of Clifton Vale and Ndoye. He did incredibly well going forward. The way that he dragged those players out of position to bring Adoma into the ascendancy to score that goal, the first goal, of course, he did incredibly well in that respect. So I think Jack Grealish does really deserve it. But you know, make no mistake about it, I thought we had a lot of players performing today, and Albert Adoma did his job incredibly well as well.
Yeah, fantastic performance. I could probably go for Jedinak as well. I could also probably go for, I would say John Terry, but that's, you know, that one instance of slipping down, letting Sam Gallagher through probably detracts quite a bit from that.
Yeah, because that could have been a game changer right there. That could have been what made the results so different.
Yeah, exactly. That's a game changer. Robert Snodgrass performed admirably. Albert Doma, of course, as well. But yeah, Jack, there's just too much about Jack Grealish on that pitch today. Far too much from him. Let's get into another one, mate. Lewis Grabant actually made his debut today. You may not have seen much of him. And he came on for 15 minutes. It seemed like about 2 or 5. Couldn't really make an impact that late on. We didn't get to see much of him. I'll reserve any thoughts for when he actually plays a fair bit, maybe. But yeah, I think he was decent. I liked what I saw. I think he was, you know, ready to do that Keenan Davis type of thing of holding the ball up. But we didn't get to see much of that.
I would love to have seen his reaction. Lewis Grabant. He's coming onto the pitch for the first time. He's debuting. He wants to score that goal against Birmingham City. That would be such a great start. You can see the lights, right? Lewis Grabban comes on, scores against Aston Villa's big, big rivals. And then Glenn Whelan comes on. So you've pretty much lost any sort of creativity to get off. By the way, I'm just messing. But I think my point is basically that Lewis Grabban wasn't going to get much of an opportunity today. We had a 2-0 lead. I think it might have even been a 1-0 lead by the time he came on the pitch initially. I can't remember. We've got to focus on keeping the ball. We've got to focus on making sure that Birmingham City don't score. So I don't think Lewis Grabban got much of an opportunity to shine, if I'm totally honest. I mean, it's hard for me to say that I was impressed with him, and it's hard for me to say that he didn't do well, because you can't blame him for not getting many opportunities. So I would say that with that question, Dean, who asked that question, you're a better analyzer of the game than me. You know, if you saw enough of him to say that he did well. Me personally, I looked at, I didn't really get to notice much from him.
That's fair enough, mate. It's his first game coming on for a cameo. That's that Dean AVFC. Thanks for that, mate. Keep him coming. There's nice transition here, mate. We're going into a match with Fulham next. So, yeah, thank you, Birmingham City, for giving up 3 points again. So easily this time. Good to see the derby run going. Good to see that you've pushed us into second place. So thank you, Birmingham City, for that brilliant second City derby win. Moving on to Fulham, mate. We'll start off with a question. Big, big point of contention is we've kept the same team for a while now. We've kept this core unit. There was a big change today against Birmingham when Yedinak come in. Dale Eaton wants to know, that's at Dale Eaton _. He wants to know, mate, does Birkir Bjarnason, who we know is four, does he come back in for Fulham? Or does Yedinak keep his place? Now, before you answer, I'm going to say, if the stamp or kick out is disciplined, and it, you know, there's a chance. These things, you know, these things do come up. Paul Robinson had the same when he kicked out at James Chester in the last derby at Villa Park. Yeah, he got, you know, he got a punish for it. It was retrospective. Maybe he has to. There's no choice. Maybe if Birkir Bjarnason comes in, it's no choice if he didn't expand.
Do you know what? I'm looking at more of these tweets as well because, you know, it's better to get a rounded opinion. A lot of Birmingham City fans are coming out there and saying stuff like, I wonder if the FA will have a look at, you know how every fan will respond. This isn't anything personal towards Birmingham City fans.
Yeah, we did this last season when Paul Robinson kicked out and Tony Jarre did it as well.
Yeah.
And Moyness did it.
Oh, exactly. And it's one of those Yerdar tweets, isn't it? You know, you get it a lot, don't you? I wonder if the FA will look at this. You know, they're looking at...
Oh, with that thinking emoji.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, they look at putting under 21 teams inside a silly cup, but I wonder if they'll look at this particular incident in this match which we didn't get. Now, I mean, looking at it, you know, it seems like Villa fans have one view of the incident, Birmingham City fans have another view of the incident. The FA, in that respect, when you look at things straight down the middle, will probably see, you know, a totally rounded judgment of it, and they'll have a look at it and decide what's right or not. I didn't see any highlights of it, so I can't make a valid judgment because I can't remember seeing enough of it to really make one right there. So, I mean, yeah, Jedinak.
Ignoring that, mate. So if he's not banned, does Bjarnason come in?
It's a really, really tough one, man. It depends on how Steve Bruce expects Fulham to play, doesn't it? If he expects Fulham to go for our jugular and, you know, make things really, really difficult up front for us, then you've got to keep Jedinak. But I'd say if we're going away to Fulham, I think we've got to start Birkir Bjarnason. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see us in control of the game. I'd like to see us offer something different. And I'd like to see Conor Hourihane and Jack Grealish get a little bit more support, I suppose, getting forward. And, you know, they won't necessarily have to do as much of the running work.
I'll be honest, Yedinak started today for a reason, and that's because it's going to be a physical battle. And he's, you know, he's an old dog. He's been around these parts. You know, he knows what it's like for teams to come at his team. So, but Bjarnason's no weak guy. He does win the ball aerially. He does throw the tackles in. It's not like you suddenly lose a physical presence. When you do lose Yedinak, but you don't lose any kind of physical presence. He's very mobile. He's very strong as well. Underrated is his strength. Bjarnason comes in for me, mate. I do like Yedinak. I wouldn't be upset if we started him. However, Bjarnason's, you know, he's made that role his, and until he cocks up in it, it's his.
It's great to see a deep-lying playmaker at Aston Villa. I can't remember the last time we had one.
It's great to see someone with discipline. Just someone with discipline like Yedinak, but also bring something slightly different than Yedinak. Because sometimes, you know, the defensive midfielder will lose their head a bit and travel up the pitch in hope of glory. Bjarnason and Yedinak don't do that. And that's really good to see that Villa's defence is suddenly so far up the pitch. But yet, whilst keeping John Terry and James Chester back, it pins the other team in their own half. Fulham play football right, mate. They play it on the floor. They play attacking football. It's Jokanovic's team under Shad Khan. They're a decent, they're a good team. They're a feel-good team. They're a team, you know, I have a soft spot for. However, you know, they're not gonna do the same things Birmingham City do, and you're not going to need, you know, you use the right tool for the job, don't you? And maybe Bjarnason's the right tool for the job.
Yeah, I'll go with Bjarnason. I think that, you know, if we're going to be playing football with Fulham, You know, we're not going to go out there and try to counter them by playing long ball. I think we've got to go with Burke, to be honest, and we've got to go with the positive, with the positive slant on things. I think he's earned it. Whilst Jedinak was fantastic against Birmingham City today, I don't think necessarily we're going to need the same kind of performance from him. And obviously Fulham, as you say, playing the ball along the floor, it's perfect for Burke, to be honest. And I think for a lot of it as well, even, you know, being the away side as well, if we are put under the cosh a little bit, you do want somebody who can, you know, kind of create an opportunity out of nothing. And Berkay Bjarnason, for example, say Fulham are pressing us back, he's got that ability to find Albert Adoma, you know, ahead of the defenders. And I'd quite like to see the possibility of that, because he is better with the ball and he has got better technique than Mile Jedinak when it comes to going forward.
So yeah, thank you very much for your questions. It's always a pleasure to answer. It's actually an honour that people send them in, mate. But yeah, move on to Fulham, quickly wrap it up. Mate, we do have to preview this game. It is happening. We're heading to it. We're going down to London. We're both going down to London in the coach and heading to it. Mm-hmm. It's going to be it's probably one of the trickier games we'll have had in a while. It's away at Fulham, a team on the rise, a team that seemed to be gunning, if not for second place, then for the promotion spot. They're off the pace a bit, but the goal's still there, mate. They're on the rise. Villa are probably the kings of the form table right now, but I wouldn't count Fulham out. At all.
They're doing really well, man. They are doing really, really well. Look, I think against Bolton as well, they did something really interesting, didn't they? You know, played Johansson instead of Kearney. He did well, by the way. I think he hit the crossbar during the game against Bolton. They also played Ryan Sessegnon up in attacking midfield. Didn't have the best of games, if I remember correctly, but you know, they've got a scary attack and they've got a very, very good midfield when it comes to, you know, playing technically. I don't know if Villa are going to be able to dominate the midfield like we have done over the last few games, because we're coming up against another side who have some very, 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 very skilled players. And let's not forget Lucas Piazon as well on the right-hand side. He's going to cause trouble, man.
Of course, Fulham being fairly decent form, mate. Apart from a draw yesterday against Bolton, they seem to have kind of just swept away teams. And I mean, these teams are Ipswich Town with a red card, Barnsley Town with a red card, Burton Albion and Forest. Still, they're winning games in style, like Villa. Villa, if there's a game that ends the winning streak, it's this one. You're completely blunt. But I still think Villa in good form, playing the way they do. Do find a win. Maybe it's not as maybe it's more like Sheffield United, where it's the last minute. Maybe it's not comfortable. Villa have every right to win this game with the form they're in, with the players they have. However, things do change. They do good things come to an end, right?
Look, Villa...
I can't comfortably say that Villa win this game just because they've won loads of games in a row.
I think we win, man. I think this is a win. I know, obviously, this is your first away game, James.
Yes, so it is, yeah.
You don't want to go in there with too much expectation. But I look at it and I think, you know, look, Fulham have just come to the end of a winning streak. They were on a four game winning streak. Bolton just ended that. You know, obviously Fulham scored as well really, really early and ended up just not being able to capitalise on it. I think we'll be the team that goes ahead and wins it. You know, we're off the back of a huge derby win against Birmingham City. We should go in there and batter Fulham. But yeah, man, your first away game, you've got to have a little bit more promise than that, surely. A little bit more optimism.
Yeah, man. But we'll get into it in prediction time. My prediction is 2-2, by the way, but I'll discuss that more when the time comes. I am full of optimism. I think this is like, going back a bit, we got a notification on the 7500 Hulk Twitter account that we'd been around for 7 years. I can't remember the last time in 7 years, so that's going back to 2011, like the January transfer window 2011, where Villa have done this well. That's a long time, mate. I mean, we haven't won eight games or seven games in a row for about 28 years, but ignore that. Ignore the winning streak. We haven't done this well on the pitch since maybe some games under Paul Lambert and that Liverpool game in the FA Cup. We haven't looked this good. I think my mind goes back to when we had like 20% possession against Southampton and we battered them on the counter. That was probably one of my number one Villa games of all time. A few under Paul Lambert were decent. We did play good football at times. The FA Cup run under Sherwood was great. The match against Liverpool, again, another top tier game. I can't remember us having just such good fun for a sustained period, being supporters of this club, and long may it continue. And I just have worries that we go into Fulham. They're a team on the rise. You know, they are seven points behind second place. But they beat the team in second place and suddenly that's carved down to four, isn't it?
Yeah, I get that. But we're the scary team here. We're the team who just look unbeatable. Because we're keeping clean sheets as well. That's the other thing. We look very, very difficult to score against. I can't really comment too much on the way that Fulham play. But, you know, as you say, look, we haven't had this kind of a sustained run of form. And yeah, we're in the Championship. I get that. And I get why, you know, people will look at it and think, yeah, you can't really call it your best run. But even whilst we've been in the Premier League, you look at it and we've been performing below expectations, or we haven't performed this much above expectations. You know, and that's what we're doing now. We're performing above our expectations because, yeah, we should be second in the Championship, but we also had an absolutely torrid start to the season, which meant that we were kind of out of it for a bit. And we've had to play ridiculously well to get to where we are right now. Ridiculously well. And that has to be commended, man. And all those different games that you mentioned, all those periods of time under Sherwood and the Lambert that we've had, I'd even say it's go as far back as Martin O'Neill to some degree. We've never been able to sustain it. It's always been sort of, you know, a couple of games here and there which we've done well in, but we'd never go on to kind of do it for a sustained period of time.
I'm 24, mate. I'm 25 in March. You're 21,
yeah.
22?
Yeah, yeah.
I can comfortably say that maybe this is the best Villa team in my lifetime, in my actual watching Villa lifetime, not because I know Paul McGrath and everyone was around when I was one and .002 in 1993 and 1995, of course. But I can't remember a Villa team this good, even in Europe or whatever. This wasn't there.
I don't know, man. For a time period, young Barry Milner and Downing was in dream midfield.
I get that completely, but then you had the Moscow incident where Paul Lambert chucks away.
That was so similar.
Martin O'Neill, they're so similar. It's like his son. But we went to Moscow under Martin O'Neill and he did chuck it away. He started a bunch of 17-year-olds and, you know, Michael Brighton, Barry Bannon, D'Alfonso, all the very good players at the time. Mark Brighton, probably the one that's really kicked out of those, to be fair. But he threw it away and every season had this real dampener at the end. It was like we could have been so much better than we've done. And I appreciate everything, the good times that came, and obviously Martin O'Neill leaving 6 days before the season. There was always a dampener. There was always something that went, it was so close.
The Moscow incident sounds like a Matt Damon movie, mate. I'm not going to lie. It's an interesting way to call it. But yeah, no,
It is an incident in the fact that Villa had to actually apologise for it.
Oh, I agree. Look, that moment in time was the absolute killer. That was the moment when we basically found out that, yeah, we're not going to capitalise on this and it's just not going to succeed for Martin O'Neill. And it was after that that we ended up just selling players and becoming a selling club and losing all our best players and never getting onto it. Because we did things at that time under O'Neill, like rejecting the signing of somebody like Falcao because he wasn't English for, you know, something like £9 million or £14 million, and then signing Emil Heskey whilst Arsenal signed Andrei Arshavin. And we did these silly things, you know, signing Steve Sidwell, for example, a flop from Reading who didn't do well at Chelsea. And I mean, there's a lot that I can talk about over there. So far, we can look at Steve Bruce and we can say that he's had some bad times and we've had some bad runs, but every time Villa have gotten something wrong under Tony Zia so far, they have gone on to fix it. We were playing awfully and we weren't pressing. We were, you know, conceding silly goals, but then we ended up fixing it. We weren't scoring enough goals. Keenan Davis came in and obviously was a young striker, you know, basically having to carry the team for a bit. And then we started playing a little bit better. Then Scott Hogan comes in and we realize that we're not playing to his strengths. But then we improve that as well. The team keeps on moving forward now. And I think under our lifetime, right, apart from when we first signed Martin O'Neill, we have always been slowly moving downwards and we have not improved at all any season. And I challenge you, actually, I can't remember any season in the last few years, apart from perhaps Alex McLeish into the Paul Lambert season, where we have actually finished above where we did the season before.
No, I can't remember, mate. I think we really need to just appreciate this. And I said to my brother, Ryan, who comes down to the Villa games with me as a season ticket holder, I said to him, he said to me, if the boos come out, you know, if we lose, the boos come out. And that's not right, is it? The fact that this Villa team should be rewarded for the joy, the genuine joy they've brought over the last 2 months. You know, even if they lose, you need to applaud them off the pitch for the way they've carried themselves. And long may that continue against Fulham, mate. I want to hear your key man for the other team, because I haven't done any research on Fulham.
All right. Okay.
That's what you're here for.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay. So if we look at Fulham, we look at Fulham as a side, you know, you look at the sort of the statistics. I love statistics, even though I was off a little bit earlier. You know, there is things you can see from them. Ryan Sessegnon scored 11 goals this season. He's been ridiculously good.
Oh, shit. I forgot Fulham have got Ryan Sessegnon. They have to have the best young talent in England, don't they, against us?
Well, yeah, but...
Well, one of the best.
And he's mainly a left back, right? But... I think it's recently we've been playing him in attacking midfield on the left-hand side, and he scored, I think he scored 9 goals in 11 games from that position. If you look at who scored, right, if you look at the who scored statistics, when he's played in that particular position, 9 goals from 11 games, and I mean, that is ridiculous. Now, bear in mind, he didn't play too well against Bolton, which, you know, could be a real blessing for Villa. He is somebody we're going to have to look at. He is only 17, though, and I feel like going up against somebody like Al Mohammadi, I think we should be able to take care of him. Also, got to look at Lucas Piazon, another player who I feel like is a fantastic young talent. Never really kicked on at Chelsea, and then you've also got to look at Tom Kearney, who obviously was on the bench in the last game. A player who has been, you know, fairly key for Fulham over the season or so. So I would say those are the key players to look at. Now, the other thing I want to say as well is this. A lot of the time I end up talking about attackers and, you know, I end up talking about the attacking midfielders and what they're going to do to Aston Villa. I think in the Barnsley game, we did talk about the defenders. Now, you've got to look at Matt Target, if I'm totally honest with you, when it comes to Fulham. I believe he's on loan from Southampton. So this is a bit of a running theme, considering we looked at Sam Gallagher last week. I believe he's on loan from Southampton. I might be wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong. He may well have just been signed by Fulham. But he's been ridiculously good for them in the last couple of games that he's played. He scored in the last game. And I think Robert Snodgrass is going to have a lot of trouble on his hands. That left-hand side, basically, for Fulham, that is going to be key throughout that game. So keep an eye on that. Al Mohammadi and Snodgrass have got a real game on their hands against Target and Sessegnon.
Well, you know, we've got to maybe show them a bit of what Birmingham City, you know, I didn't mean that Birmingham City tried to show us a bit of that muscle. And I am worried about Sessegnon, I won't lie. But let's get into it, mate. We really, really want to hear your prediction for this. I say 2-2. And the reason I say 2-2 is because I want if my first away game isn't capped off with a win at the, you know, rather admittedly beautiful surroundings of Craven Cottage and the surrounding area of Fulham in London, I want there to be a last minute goal that gives us an undeserved draw. Brilliant. That would be 2-2, mate. That'd be fucking incredible. Because, you know, there's nothing like, if you're going to lose, that you're going to lose. But if Fulham are a team on the ascendancy, Villa are the team at the top, bar Wolves, you know, we're cutting Wolves away from this conversation, far and gone almost. But Villa are the team at the top. If you're Fulham and you drop a last minute goal to Aston Villa to either lose or draw the match, that's a gut punch. That is like you're good, but you're not good enough. And that would feel
great. The other thing is you got to remember the pressure is going to be on Fulham now. They dropped points this weekend. You know, they really couldn't afford to. They, alongside a lot of the other teams around us, you know, dropped points that they couldn't afford to lose. Now, I think they're going to be in for another shock to their system, because teams like Fulham, they do really, really well against the teams who are, you know, further down on the table. But you look at some of their players and you just kind of wonder if they're really going to cause Villa too many problems. You know, Ryan Sessegnon might do fantastically well against you know, normal championship defenders, but you put him up against the likes of Al Mohammadi and he might well freeze. You don't know that with a player that sort of age, right? Even if he is banging in goals, right? I think really in the form that we're in, having won 7 games straight and having just beaten our rivals, Birmingham City, who were playing well. This isn't a Birmingham City team who have been getting their asses handed to them week in, week out. This is a Birmingham City team who scored 6 goals in the last 2 games. Having come off the back of that, such a difficult derby, and making it look comfortable, I think we're going to go over that Fulham game and I really think we're going to get a victory. We've been predicting victories for absolute fun on the Hulkcast, and it's refreshing to hear you to mention a draw, James, but I'm not faltering off this. We're winning this game and I'm going to go 2-1. It's going to be tight.
2-1, 2-2, mate. So there's a goal between us. All that stands between us is a single goal. Remember, as always, the prediction game that we started by Trevor Hood. Thank you for recording us because we keep forgetting to do that. The prediction game is only, you only get success if you get the exact scoreline, mate. We don't do win, draw, lose. We go.
Yeah, in. I mean, I've tried to claim quite a lot. I'm just saying that I've done fairly well on it predicting results, but maybe that just shows my hand as an optimist.
Fair. I can't fault you. 2-1 would be great. I wouldn't be upset. I wouldn't be greatly upset with a 2-2 at all. I think just don't drop them points to Derby, maybe. But the battle for second place continues. Any final thoughts as we head, me and you heading down to London next week to watch Fulham. But any final thoughts on today's topics? We've got we did speak about a lot, Birmingham City, Fulham, all in between. Any final thoughts, Danny?
I was going to say that I'm feeling incredibly good, and I think that I said to you today that I just really really felt like talking about Villa, and that we make this a long podcast. So I do hope that the listeners enjoyed it today. If there was too much waffle, or if you prefer us to kind of do other things on the podcast, obviously do get in touch. We would absolutely love to hear your feedback. But yeah, it just feels absolutely great to be a Villa fan again. You know, it's great like walking around Birmingham with your Villa shirt on nowadays, and people are smiling and people are, pointing you out for it. Villa fans are, we're happy about the way the club is going. Do you remember bumping into Villa fans, for the last 2 seasons or so, and always the conversation would be a negative one? It was happen. That's what it would be. It's like, oh mate, it's not good, is it? It's not good, is it? Finally, it feels really good to have that. And it feels good to be involved with football again, because I almost feel as though the way things were going, it was sapping the life out of us as football fans. Now, I know I'm going off onto a very, very general tangent over here, but I feel like this is a big, big win for us. You know, historically, if we end up going up, we're going to look back at this game and think like, winning is a habit, James. Making winning a habit is one thing. Winning a couple of games, winning a few games in a row is one thing. But when you've won 7 games in a row, you can sit there and say that the mentality of the club has changed. And there is a winning mentality there, because you don't do that. You don't do that coincidentally. And it was nice to see that today. And it was nice to see all the pressing from the players. And I think the final thought to say really is fair play to Steve Bruce for turning up today, and fair play to him for, doing such a great job with Villa, despite all that's happened with him this week. And long may it continue.
Well, someone's turned on the vacuum cleaner in my house, so that suggests it's time to end the podcast. As usual, I'm at Jamie Rushton on Twitter, James Rushton. You can catch Daniel Raza at DH Raza on Twitter. And of course, the blog is at 7500 Holt. Thank you very much for tuning in. It's been a great, great, great weekend for everyone of a claret and blue persuasion in Birmingham, of course. And the city, of course, is ours. And we'll catch you directly after the Fulham game. Goodbye.